the unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. What I would like to talk about today is that phrase from Rules for Meditation, Dogen's Rules for Meditation, which you, those of you who are here for the introductory retreat, recited yesterday. When the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. Many, many years ago, when I was a lay trainee, one of the first Dharma talks that I heard was given by one of our British monks. And I remember asking him a question, although I can't remember what the question was. His answer has stayed in my mind over these many years. I asked him a question. I brought up two points from something that he had said. And he said to me, "Those two things that you have said do not stand against one another." That phrase, "these two things do not stand against one another," have been the most helpful teaching to me for many years, and in particular, over this past year. I was so struck by that phrase when I heard it, because I had never heard it before. And I thought, that must be a British phrase, you know, because this is a British monk. But, you know, when I was reflecting on it, it could be, and I could be wrong, but it could be that in our culture, in our country, we tend really to want to see things in terms of black and white, in terms of the good guys and the bad guys, in terms of gain and loss, joy and sorrow, sickness and health, rich and poor. And when we are having difficulty with something, it is because we are leaving something out. We're rubbing only a part of the elephant, you know? We're seeing with just one eye. You know, in order to explain things to ourselves, we often just grab onto one opposite and push aside the other. And this reminds me of this wonderful phrase by Venerable Yoka Genkaku when he says, "Good sir, do not malign the vast blue heavens as you gaze at them through a narrow reed." So the truth partakes really of what we think of as the opposites, what Reverend Master Jiu used to call the third position, the realm beyond the opposites, the mind of meditation. And this is talked about by many different masters, many different scriptures speak of it. When the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. When the opposites arise, we have lost sight. We've lost sight of it. And the starting point and the basic premise is that we all have the Buddha mind. It's the recognition that we have it, whether we know it or not, whether or not we're Buddhists, you know, it doesn't really matter. The Buddha didn't care what it was called, but there is that which is greater than ourselves that we are all part of and that everything partakes of. And it permeates all of us and all things. So our scripture that we all recited this morning says, "Preserve well, for you now have." That is all. The fifth law of the Buddhist five laws of the universe is that the intuitive knowledge of the Buddha nature occurs to all of us. Intuitive knowledge, we all know it. You know, we all know it. We have all experienced it at some time in our life, whether or not we think of it in those terms or whether or not we would actually recognize it in that particular way. All beings have the Buddha nature. And we don't have to go out and look for it. We have everything we need. And our meditation practice is to enable us to have a direct experience of what is already there, to quiet down ourselves enough so that we can see what it is that we've put in the way. So, from the Buddhist point of view, things coexist. So, although the opposites may have a functional reality, they do not have an ultimate reality. And as Kanshi Sosan, one of our ancestors, says in a poem which is translated as "that which is engraved upon the heart that trusts to the eternal," he starts off by saying the way to the ultimate is not hard. Simply give up picking and choosing. Just by not giving in to hatred and craving will your heart and mind be as clear and bright as the realm beyond the opposites. But let a hair's breadth of discriminatory thought arise, and you have made heaven and earth strangers to each other. When the craving to possess emerges before your eyes, do not persist in following its perverting path. When you allow gratification and dissatisfaction to compete within you, they will create a sickness in your heart. That phrase, the craving to possess. You know, I think that it's not just to possess material things, it's really to possess anything. You know, the craving to possess certainty, craving to possess clarity, the craving to possess closure, you know, to get some kind of understanding. All of these things are a form of craving, and when we allow them, as he says, the craving to possess, do not persist in following its path. When you allow gratification and dissatisfaction to compete within you, they will create a sickness in your heart. If you are not aware of the deeper purpose for which we train, you toil in vain, however pure your thoughts. The all-embracing is perfect, and like the great vault of space, it lacks for nothing and has nothing in excess. Because we are good at grasping after or pushing away, we are not one with it. So this vault of space, you know, this sense of spaciousness, being at ease. We can relax, we can take a deep breath. There is room for everything in the vault of spaciousness, you know, and that's the point, because there is something larger that is holding all of us and is holding all things, and that we can rest in that and we can entrust ourselves to that. There is a bigger picture that we can't see, which is actually fortunate, because I think if we saw it, we probably wouldn't be able to handle it. So, you know, we just see the tip of the iceberg. And we don't really need to see the bigger picture. We just simply need to know that there actually is going on, there's more going on than what it is that we can see. So how is it that we can open ourselves into this spaciousness, and how do we bring the Dharma to bear on what it is that is troubling us? What are we going to do with all these opinions, all these views, all these judgments that we have? You know, Dogen says, cut all ties, give up everything. And, you know, when you first read that, you can think, gosh, you know, give up everything. What is he talking about? You know, is he talking about giving up all our possessions, giving up, you know, giving up everything that's important to us? I can remember when I told my friends I was going to become a monk, they said, what? What? You're going to give up? What are you going to give up? You're going to give up all of your interests, you're going to give up. You're going to give up movies. You're going to give up men. You're going to give up. I used to have this little Carmen Ghia that I used to drive. Loved this little car. You're going to give it up. And actually, you know what Dogen is talking about? He's talking about giving up our opinions. Because he goes on to say, give up everything. Think of neither good nor evil. Consider neither right nor wrong. And I can say that after 25 years, giving up my car, my hairdo, you know, movies, all of those things. I mean, that was a piece of cake. That was a piece of cake compared to giving up opinions. I am still working on this. The monastic community will confirm this. Okay, so, you know, it's not something, we don't give it up overnight. We don't give it up overnight. But there are a number of different ways that we can work with this. And I'd just like to share with you some of the things that I have found helpful in working on giving up opinions. And the first thing, of course, is that we need to simply be aware when opinions are arising. You know, and how often do we say, God, I can't stand this, you know, or he's really a jerk, or gee, that was just awful. That was awful. You know, or how marvelous, you know, wasn't that marvelous? We tend to talk in these extremes. And again, now this is what Kanchi Sosan has to say about it. There is no need to hunt for truth. Simply stop exhaling personal opinions. Isn't that wonderful? Oh, and then he says, cease your abiding in dualistic views and take care not to chase after them or seek them out. He doesn't say they're not going to arise, you know, so they arise naturally, but he says, don't abide in them. Don't abide in them. We don't have to hang out in our opinions. Seek to chase after them. We don't need to chase after them or seek them out. For as soon as right and wrong arise, confusion sets in and your thoughts will go awry. The two exist because of the one, but do not try to hold on to this one. So, you know, anything that we try to hold on to, if we're trying to hold on to the opposites, that creates suffering. If we're trying to hold on to the one, that creates suffering, because those themselves are opposites. You know, there's the opposite and the one. That creates another dualistic kind of thing that we then need to deal with. So when we find ourselves sinking into the sea of opinions. We can think about some different ways of working with that. One of the things that Reverend Master Jiyu taught us when she came back from Japan, she taught us a mantra. She taught us a mantra, and it was, I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Now we might think, oh gee, that's easy. But just try tacking that on the end of one of your favorite opinions and see how that feels, you know. This is the practice. Can you say, give, you know, offer an opinion and say, and I could be wrong. And just, it's a good, you know, it's a good experience because you can feel how attached you may be to it. I could be wrong, but I'm really not. So, you know, and you have to have a sense of humor about it. You have to have some compassion for yourself when you're doing this because this is not something that is going to... It's not something that we're going to be able to resolve, you know, in the next few years, probably. And sometimes it's downright embarrassing. It can be embarrassing. So, you know, you just have to be prepared for that. But it gives you an opportunity to see, can you offer an opinion and can you hold it lightly? You know, can you just hold it lightly? So another tool that you can use if you would like to experiment with this is something, again, that Reverend Master Jiyu taught. Reverend Master Hubert told us that Reverend Master Jiyu told him when he was doing translations, translating scriptures and other Buddhist writings, to use the word and as often as possible, instead of the word but, instead of but, because it is more inclusive. And she made some changes in our scriptures with that in mind. The one that comes to mind is our Kesa verse that we recited this morning. How great and wondrous are the clothes of enlightenment. Formless, it used to be yet. Formless yet embracing every treasure. And she changed the yet to formless and embracing every treasure. I wish to unfold the Buddha's teaching that I may help all living things. So formless does not stand against embracing. And it changes the meaning quite dramatically. So I started to try, when I could remember, to use the word and in my daily language, and that was very interesting. Using and instead of but. Some of you, I have, when I talk with you, can see you're laughing already. I will say, now wait a minute, when it occurs to me, it's not but, let's see what happens if we use and here when we're talking about it. I was talking with Reverend Master Hubert about this the other day, reminding him of this, and I said to him, you know, when you use the word and, it opens up the door to a much more spacious view. And he said, it does a lot more than that. He said, it takes the door right off its hinges. Okay, now I want to give you an example of that very thing. In the book, Jizo Bodhisattva, by Reverend Chosan Bays, Reverend Hang Shur, who is the director of the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, has a foreword in that book. And he tells, this is a piece of that foreword. He is talking about the fact that he suggested to a group of meditators that he was working with that they choose a significant elder of their choice and ask for that elder's wisdom regarding the next step in, you know, the journey, the spiritual journey. And he said to them, visit your elder 3 times and listen carefully to the concerns and advice the elder provides. And then 3 weeks later, he says, we gathered to hear the stories. One of the meditators, we'll call her Sue Ellen, explained her background. And Sue Ellen says, I hadn't talked with my mother for 7 years. She said, she and I always disagreed about my life, and she had given up on me as a lost cause. Something about this project you gave us hit the right spot at just the right time. Since I've been meditating for 6 years, maybe I've gained a bit of stillness and composure. Anyway, I called my mother after I got home from class, and she started right in on me. Now, after 7 years, just picked up right where she had left off. And she didn't miss a beat, you know? It's wonderful. I don't know. I mean, we all can relate to that, right? I mean, it's just something about this story. Every time I read it, I just, you know, it's just really something. But she said, so what Ellen said to her mom was, Mom, you never change, and I love you for it. All right, and I love you for it. Not, Mom, you never change, you know? So, I love you for it, I'm coming right over, she said. I walked in her house, gave her a hug, and we didn't stop talking for 8 hours. Okay? The next morning, she asked me to teach her to meditate. So, there's something about this that really just sprung up for me. And it has to do with the fact that when we use the word and, the ball is in our court. You know, somehow the situation opens up and we are the ones that then need to take a step. We need to do something. I had an experience of this many years ago, before I became a monk. I was living in the Bay Area, and I was working in an agency, and I was really stirring it up there. They put me on probation. They told me I had 6 months to shape up. See, I had even more opinions then than I do now. And so I wasn't really sure what to do, but I had just started to go to hear Reverend Master Jiu. She was teaching at UC, and she was giving some of those lovely lectures that are now... some of which have appeared in the first volume of Roar of the Tigress. And someone there, I didn't have the nerve to ask a question, there were a lot of people there, but somebody else had the same problem I did, and he said, I'm having a really terrible time with my boss. I don't know what to do. And she looked at him and she said, your boss has the Buddha nature. And you know, I was absolutely galvanized. And the thing is, once I heard that, I could not then pretend that I hadn't. You know? So I could say, you know, I'm having a lot of trouble with my boss, and he has the Buddha nature. And, you know, that really turned everything around for me. turned the whole thing around. And I, I stayed and worked at that agency for about another 10 or 12 years until I became a monk. And he didn't ask me to teach him how to meditate. He didn't, you know. But the thing of it was that I saw him in a totally different light, you know. Something about it just opened the door, and I saw him in a new light. I saw what he was struggling with on this job. He was actually, you know, this was a private agency and had a contract with the state, so he had two different administrations he was trying to deal with, and he's kind of stuck in the middle and feeling a lot of pressure, and it was influencing the decisions that he was making and the like, and I just began to see a much bigger picture, so that I found I was, you know, able to be much more empathetic with his situation. And I quit making such a fuss. So I can attest to the fact that it does work. And you know, I think we all do this lots of times without even realizing it. And if we can think about these tools when we are in situations, in very difficult situations, you know, where we are having difficulty with family members, really it can be anyone or any situation. It doesn't really need to be a particular person, but a difficult situation that we're having. If we say, you know, I have a whole lot of work to do, but I'm really tired, you know, that's kind of a dead end because it doesn't really go anywhere. But if we can say, I've got a lot to do, and I'm tired, there's a kind of a willingness comes across, you know, we're holding both of these things. We're actually seeing how can we hold both of these things at the same time. And the thing about all of this, of course, is that it opens us to find ways of looking at things in entirely different ways, so that we can see that there actually are any number of ways that we can work in a situation. You know, the other thing is that there is never just one way. There's never just one right way. I grew up thinking there was one right way, and it was my job to find out what it was. And so, boy, it took me a long time. When I heard the Buddhist teaching, no, there is not one right way, boy, I was really thrown, because then what, you know? If we feel like there's just one way and we can just nail it down, then we have some sense of security. You know, it's a false sense of security, but we have some sense maybe that we know what to do. But in actual fact, the Buddhist teachings, you know, point to impermanence. They point to using our meditation as our guide to do what is good. They point to using the precepts. And all of this, of course, changes. It's constantly changing, so that what is good to do one day may not be good to do the next day. Or what is good for one of us to do in a situation, in that same situation, it might not be good for somebody else to do it. So it's a risky business, very risky. But would we have it any other way, really? You know, we're all here because we tried those other ways and we found they didn't work. And so, we have a sense that there is another way that is really more in harmony with what we know to be true. So, the last thing that I want to mention is the use of the gassho. This is really the most powerful unifying mudra, we could say, gesture. And you know, when you actually do it, you can feel things coming together. Reverend Master Ji used to say, put both halves of your brain together. And this is how we can do it. And we want to do it really with our hands really together. You know, if we leave a space in there, there's room for all kinds of stuff to get in there. Doubts and fears, you know, and all kinds of stuff can get in there. So we want to do this with real, you know, kind of energy and confidence. We can. And you can actually, you know, you can work with this for yourself, and you can experience whether or not this is helpful. You can do this physically, if you are in a situation where you can't do it physically, you can do it mentally. You can do it mentally, but it has a very profound effect. You can do this in terms of offering merit for someone who is having a difficult time. And in particular, you can offer merit for somebody that you are having a difficult time with. You know, some of you have had that experience, offering merit for someone who you're having trouble with. It's very, again, because you can't really sustain the opposites. When you are offering merit for someone, you are actually coming from that place of unity. And you are really acknowledging the fact that there is something that is greater than both you and this other person that is holding both of you. And you know, we had this transfer of merit ceremony this morning in which we were offering merit for beings, both known. Oh, I am sorry. Both known and unknown. This is a very helpful practice when you are watching television. You know, I hear a lot of people say it is so painful and difficult to watch television these days because of all the suffering that is going on in the world. And it's so easy to get caught up in it and to feel anger and distressed about injustice that you see, that we see. And it kind of brings up all kinds of feelings in us. And yet it's really good to know what is going on, and it's good to see how it is that we can ground ourselves in the middle of suffering, and how it is that we can offer merit. And so one of the practices that we developed here at the Abbey when we watch the news, if there are scenes of war scenes, you know, if we are seeing what is going on in countries where people are fighting with one another and killing one another, we simply ground ourselves in our meditation and we make gassho. We make gassho for all of the people involved, not just, if it's U.S. troops, not just the U.S. troops, it is whoever the U.S. is fighting at any particular time in any particular place. And for all the suffering that is being created, if there are scenes of, you know, the latest political scandal, politicians being called on the carpet for what they are doing with their constituency, you know, we offer merit. We offer merit for the politicians, we offer merit for the constituents, so that everybody is included. And in this way, we are reminding ourselves that there is that which is greater than ourselves, and that we are connected. We are connected with all beings, so that any suffering that we see is really suffering that we are sharing in. You know, we can't kind of just sort of cut it off and turn away from it. Because when we do that, we are actually turning away from some part of ourselves. So the gassho, the gesture of unifying, of asking for help, of bowing, you know, it has so many meanings. We don't have to think of what it is at any particular time. We can just do it when it seems good, and just trust that it is, it's helping ourselves and it is helping others. So these are Kanshi Sosan's last words of advice to us. Since both sides of a duality are in themselves incomplete, how can either one be absolute? Rules and standards do not exist for that which is supreme and ultimate. Hence, devote your heart to being impartial, for then whatever activity you undertake will attain stillness. Completely cleansed of wariness and doubts, your true faith will then harmonize discords and straighten out irregularities, so that nothing lingers on, nothing is clung to by memory. Bright and empty of expectations, just functioning naturally, your mind will not wear out its strength, for it is not a place for judgmentalism. However, discriminatory consciousness and feelings will find this difficult to fathom. So, may we all practice this together.